Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padre Greedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
And welcome to another Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with Rebecca Watson. And our guests tonight are Tracy King, DC Turner, and Tim Minchin. Tracy King is the Managing Director of February Marketing, and is the organiser of TAM London, and was a co-organiser of the Big Libel gig. She speaks on a range of topics, including viral marketing, advertising psychology, and using marketing in science communication and critical thinking. She is the producer of Tim Minchin's Storm movie, a regular writer for Skeptic and the UK edition of the Skeptic magazine, and her work has appeared in Nature and elsewhere. DC, or Dan Turner, is a designer and animator with a unique style of character design. He has worked for various brands such as Sony, Vodafone, Barclays, Motorola, T-Mobile and Woolworths. As well as animated shorts, he designs and builds award-winning Flash games and composes soundtracks. Tim Minchin is... well, you know who Tim Minchin is. Anyone who heard the live broadcast of this show will notice that I've re-recorded the intro, so you don't get to hear Tim's delightful a cappella version of our theme tune. But unfortunately there was a technical error with the recording, so I'm afraid that's gone, so you just have to imagine it. But I hope you enjoy the rest of the interview anyway. So Tracy, why don't you start by, well, tell us why Tim's here, and basically let's talk about what Storm
I,
is
I
and how you got involved
Tim's
in
here.
That.
I think you invited him.
I was in the pub.
It's like a barnacle, we just picked him up on the way.
He's always here, he's just really quiet in the background.
Storm.
We have made an animated movie version of Tim Minchin's epic 9-minute beat poem Storm. Because we can, is the... basically, I went to Robin Ince's Nine Lessons and Carols 2 years ago, and I'd never heard of Tim and hadn't heard any of his work, and still haven't, to be fair. So everybody else came on, who's brilliant, and then at the end, this sort of weird-looking, kind of big-haired, shoeless guy wanders on. And I thought, they've let a homeless in. And then he said, I'm going to do a 9-minute beat poem. And I thought, oh, Jesus. But then it was this kind of... everything I've ever thought about everything, but done in a sort of way that I could never hope to achieve, and it stayed with me. So that night I was thinking, how can I manipulate this situation to get myself into it? And and so we all went to Skeptics in the pub, and coincidentally, and through the mutualness of Rebecca Watson, we're introduced, and I said,
you do have some of the best mutualness in the game.
That's amazing. That's my superpower.
You should check out her
people.
Mutualness.
And so a film was born.
How does it feel to discover Tim Minchin?
Yeah. I do, I'm very,
it's
very
good
proud
of you to finally come along.
He is, yeah. I mean, he's kind of surpassed the master now, but...
found,
you know,
the cubic zirconia in the...
for the first couple of years, it was...
It does feel like an epic thing. It's quite
weird to
be at this point where now it's a film.
Yeah.
This crazy thing that I failed to edit. Poorly edited.
Yeah, I mean, when you first did it, I remember it immediately made it to the intertubes, and it wound up on YouTube, but it was just this really poorly recorded, you know, there
wasn't
any video.
Well, it was that night, someone bootlegged it that night, that
right.
Tracy saw it, yeah.
And that drove you insane.
Yeah, well, it was pretty awful, because, I mean, I know the thing that attracts like-minded people to the piece is the text, but for me, the form of it, and for Dan and Tracy as well, now that it's a film, the form and the way it's instrumental, it's orchestrated and stuff is sort of important to it, and I was like, you can't hear the backing track, what's the point? And so I very quickly turned around and made sure I got a reasonable version up. I mean, I'm not averse at all to giving my stuff away, so I just got it up there, but we get another bash at the interwebs now with the film. Well, we're value-adding, man.
That's the whole idea as well, is to actually give it away for free once it's done.
Yeah.
Obviously without typos and...
Yeah, that's right.
...more production.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, there's, with everything any of us make, I suppose, Tracy and what she does and Dan and what he does, there's entertainment's kind of the primary goal of it. But with this piece especially, which is definitely has proselytizing elements to it, we're all motivated.
Stealth education.
Yeah, stealth education.
Insidious,
yeah.
Insidious, I think.
Yeah, we are all motivated by the desire to give people something that they can forward to their mates and go, this is what I think, sort of thing.
So after that performance, Storm really became something of a skeptic favourite and something of an anthem. I mean, what was that? You know, what was that like for that to happen?
Well, it was my in as well. It opened the door to this world and to meeting you guys and all that sort of thing, so it's quite interesting. The previous show 2 years earlier, I had written a very short song stealing from Francis Ween's excellent How Mumbo Jumbo Corrupted, what's the
Conquered
word?
The
Conquered
world.
The World, a phrase out of that book which he had stolen off a journalist, the name of whom I forget. The song was called If You Open Your Mind Too Much, Your Brain Will Fall Out, which was just a sort of my four very long line version of Randy's Million Dollar Challenge, basically. I was inspired by who's the dude? Peter Bowditch, who runs the Million Arseholes, the Millennium Project, the Australian skeptic site. And that and through that I discovered Randy and his Million Dollar Challenge, and I wanted to write that. So that kind of gave me a little window into this world, and James wrote to me and at that stage and said, you know, good work. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. There's a sort of there's a community of people who are interested in this stuff. Then next time I sat down to write a show, I really just thought, I can't spend the rest of my career writing. I was aware, I've always been aware that you have to be wary of, I guess, what you guys were just saying, the stealthness. At some point, it's not stealth anymore. You're just standing up, banging on. And when I wrote Storm, my intent was to kind of get it. You know, I wanted to go, right, this is it, this is what I think, and then I don't have to say anything else about the subject ever again.
Into a 9-minute poem.
Yeah, that's true. Well, whatever it took, I thought, I'm going to write a poem, because I've always done beat poems in my shows ever since before I was even really doing comedy. I thought, I'm going to get it all out there, and that'll be it. I'm going to say my bit, and then, but of course, rather than that, it's opened up a slippery slope of preaching, and now I just want to keep writing on the subject. But unfortunately, I've already... I'm trying to write a new sort of similar thing, you know, Storm 2 sort of thing at the moment for my new show, and I go, oh, I've blown it, really, because I've said, isn't this enough? And once you've said, isn't this enough, you've asked...
You've
done it. You've asked the question.
Can just start the next song with no?
Yeah.
P.S.
No? Ah, well, then what about... So it's been great.
Dan, let's... Let's have a brief interlude to talk something about the technicalities of animating.
Yeah.
You're the animator.
Fine.
You've been working on this pretty solidly for over a year now.
Well, God, over a year. Since about it's January 2009, I think.
Jesus, really?
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Yeah, we, you know, went out for a meal and decided that night, and then met up sort of the week afterwards. And then from then on, it's pretty much just been whenever I could fit it in outside of work, drawing pictures of someone's stupid face for 24 hours a day.
Trying
to get it right.
You should have drawn my good face.
Yeah, that's true. We need both. We need likeable you and
one.
Disgusting party-ruining Tim as well. Yeah, it's been a ridiculously long, drawn-out process, and I think one of the main reasons for that is that it's ballooned from what we previously thought it would be. We thought it was going to be a little fun project, you know, maybe a year at the most, to actually... to try and add an extra level of sort of accessibility to the poem. And you know, there are some people that a beat poem is apparently a bit too arduous.
Yeah.
So we're trying to put a bit of a sheen on it. And the annoying thing, but people just kept coming out of the woodwork and saying, oh, I'll help with that.
Yeah.
And they're very good at what they do. So it ended up, we've got a much better looking, much sort of higher aspiring film than we started with. So we're now talking to festivals around the world, and we have a proper film on our hands.
But also, I think it's quite important not to kind of underestimate, I think, something we actually probably didn't think about, which is that you can't just animate a 9-minute monologue of just a guy lip-syncing. You've actually got to add in visual jokes, and that's kind of, I don't know, it's sort of, I don't think that even really occurred to me at the start, that we have to be funny as well, and so it balloons into a bigger project, because all of a sudden you're adding this
creative.
Yeah, we're exploring the mind of Tim Minchin, because we can go anywhere with this visually, because all you have to do is draw it, and actually that makes it a much, much bigger
and
project.
That's why I'm naked throughout the piece.
Yes. And now, even. They're all naked. Yes.
And naked now.
Yeah. So beyond that, beyond Tim being naked throughout the piece, tell us some of the approaches that you took then to make it, you know, obviously this is a radio show, so don't go into too much detail, but tell us about how the visual...
Yes, well, describing a comic show.
I brought a book of sketches. We could just hold that up.
I haven't seen the film yet, so I'm as interested as the
spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, we just replaced him with a stick man essentially halfway through.
What do you mean, replaced me with a stick man? He just accurately reflected me as a two-dimensional figure.
Yes. No, I mean, what it started as is my day job for a few years has been, you know, working with various sort of drawing programs and things like that, and the reason we were so keen to get on with this was that you don't ever get to do this kind of work 9 to 5 during the week. So it was essentially just a venting thing, really. And it really does just involve, you know, sitting down for 2 years and drawing every last damn scrap of action that gets described in the 10 minutes. And we decided not to cop out and not to do any sort of automated or rigged animation. We decided to draw the entire thing in kind of a traditional 2D sense. You know, it reeks of, you know, sort of, Christ, I mean, Genndy Tartakovsky, the guy that does Samurai Jack, and John Chris Felucci from Ren and Stimpy. You know, we're trying to really make it an emotive and fun thing to watch, but the downside of that is you have to draw every expression anew. You can't just stick something on the page and tell the computer to send it over there, because that's not particularly fun and inspiring to watch.
And it's not exploiting your talent. I mean, it's about making a film that exploits what you're good at to the full.
There's that as well. It's a bit disingenuous to say, yeah, they're just doing it for the project. I mean, it's to promote the good ideas, and obviously to promote myself as well.
You always, whenever you make a bit of work, you want to exploit the tricks you've got, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And the bits I have seen, quite a few bits, and in terms of adding humour, it's amazing how delicate it is. You know, obviously I understand how delicate it is. I've done this poem live, you know, 150 times or whatever, and I notice that the slightest change in timbre of my voice, or how aggressively I go at something, or how late I start something after the beat, or it changes the kind of intent of it. Similarly, when you drop a word into the bit of typography into it, or when you represent an astrological figure and the look the astrological figure has on its face, the tiniest, every frame has a sort of impact on how seriously the piece takes itself, and on the kind of timing of the humour, and you could very easily cut across the humour. And so what Dan, from the bits I've seen, has done extremely successfully, and everyone who's been involved in it, is compliment the humour and enhance it, rather than it could so easily go wrong.
It's a really tough line to walk, actually, because, you know, the poem is
dense.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, it's sort of 99% of the appeal. You know, we're doing this because the script is already so great. And the tricky thing was to realise that we didn't have to promote or represent every single thing that you're talking about. You know,
because the words are doing it.
So. Yeah, I mean, we had to essentially bring the visuals up to a level where we could just relax and just have a blank screen if we needed to, and let the words come out. Because you do that on stage, you don't constantly leap and emote all over the place. Yeah. And, you know, the tricky thing is that the project is so much bigger than myself, and it represents, you know, it's such a nicely condensed argument that the worries that you have over every single frame in any normal animation, they're just compounded many thousands of times, because, you know, we've been running a production blog and there's people around the world checking in to see how we're going, and people aren't particularly kind on the internet and this is going on YouTube, you know, people.
But they have been people, with us, though.
I know, that's the
every
ominous thing.
Every single person has been kind.
But, you know, if you look on YouTube, people will find the most inane and cuddly reasons to threaten to kill each other.
You have a terrible disadvantage in that a lot of your life is on the internet.
Exactly. Yeah,
what you need to learn to do is not give up about what people say on the internet.
Well, then it's not just the fact that people on the internet are jerks. It's that for the past 2 years, people have been building this up in their heads.
You have
quite a bit to live up to. And
yeah, don't worry.
Thanks, Beck. It feels much better.
It's going to
ruin everybody's expectations. Actually.
Well, what I've seen, I've seen some of the clips you've released online, and what I like is that they're not just a literal representation of what's happening. And I think that's fantastic because, the appeal of the poem is that it builds up a picture in, the theater of the mind. And you can't compete with that on a literal scale. So you have to throw in your own flourishes. I think you do a really good job of that.
The number one rule of filmmaking is show it, don't tell it. But you've been saddled with a piece that tells it to within an inch of its bloody life. So you're sort of working in an interesting...
Yeah, it's
whereas
a nice
with
thing
a film, you take the script and take out as many lines as possible and replace them with pictures. That's not
an
option.
Exactly. I mean, you didn't write the poem with any sort of mind of cinematography.
No, that's
you'd
right.
You'd be straight.
Nor was I particularly open to the idea that the text would be...
Well, yeah,
not that it ever came up. No, that's
they
right.
They cut out an entire verse.
Yeah, the whole thing.
Just pictures.
Yeah, that'd be all right.
So, Tim, did you, along the way, I mean, you said you have, along the way, seen bits of the animation, but have you had any more input into it?
I've had very little input into it. My intention was always to stay out of it, because in this project, I'm the script writer and the voiceover artist. Basically, I have no expertise in film. Obviously, though, it's my piece, and Dan and Tracy were at pains to bounce all the character sketches off me and stuff. And actually, I did early on I think I look a bit, cross or fat. I was keen not to be too ugly and stuff. The things that someone like me thinks about with the kind of overview of my entire career, I try to, you don't see many photos of me without my makeup on. There's a reason for that. And
so the fat drug addict model didn't go down
the smacky version of me. No, I had very little input. When I was asked for a bit of feedback on characters, I went, well, I guess I would say this, but since then, it wasn't the right use of my time to get involved in this apart from anything else, because it's not what I should be doing. I have to get on and write my next bit, and these guys are making a film, so and I loved what I saw. I guess if I didn't know Tracy and Dan when the idea came up, I was just, as Dan said, it wasn't the scale of it wasn't apparent to us at that stage. I was just like, oh, these guys seem pretty bright and they want to make a little animation. Good, all right, great. It's not going to hurt me at all.
See you in a month.
Yeah, see you in a month. Yeah, great. Yeah, sketch that up, yeah. but as I saw bits, I went, oh, wow, this is great, and beyond my ability to give any intelligent feedback that would help the thing. So it was a relief, because if it had become as big a deal as it's become and I didn't like the work, we'd be in all sorts of trouble, really, if I just didn't like it. But I loved it, so I've just relaxed and I haven't really got involved at all in the last few months. I haven't been able to.
And you guys don't have much further to go, right? I mean, your premiere is coming up October 16th, is
Yeah,
that
it's
right?
in about a week. Yeah. You can probably hear the fear
half of
in
it
my voice.
Do you want to tell us about the premiere?
I'd love to. The premiere is part of Tam London, which Neil mentioned in the intro, is a shindig that I organise. It's a big sceptical conference, basically. We call it a celebration of science and critical thinking. And I really wanted the premiere to have as big a platform as we could possibly give it, but not as a standalone thing just in case it was rubbish. So so there's the Saturday night at Tam London is dedicated to the premiere of Storm, and we're going to show it. I mean, it's not going to be the final version, but that's often the way with kind of private premieres anyway. But there are tickets for sale. If you go to tamlondon.org, you can buy tickets to the conference itself, but you can also buy tickets separately to the premiere. So if people want to come along next Saturday night or whenever it is by the time this goes out on podcast, tomorrow or whatever it is, and see Storm and be part of the exclusive club of 1,000 people who will be the only ones who have seen it. Yeah.
And we'll be sitting around, Dan and Tracy and I will be sitting around doing more of this, basically, taking questions.
But with clothes.
Yeah, we'll be wearing trousers. Yeah.
Dodging rotten fruit.
Yeah. None of that.
We'll be selling rotten fruit outside, just in case.
You're listening to Little Atoms this week with me, Neil Denny, and Rebecca Watson, and we've got a full studio. Our guests are Tracy King, DC Turner and Tim Minchin. Let's move on from Storm then, and let's talk about other stuff that people were doing, and we can talk a little bit more about Tam London in the second half. But I want, Tim, let's talk about... In November is the beginning of your RSC production of Matilda, so let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, slightly different from Storm or from my other live things. I've written songs for a children's musical. Well, it's a family musical, really. It's a Roald Dahl story, obviously. Well, not obviously. And I was approached about 18 months ago, or I guess about the same time, actually. We met January last year by the RSC to talk about this idea they had, or at least they had Dennis Kelly had written a script adaptation that was at that point completely lyric and music free, with a view to it becoming a sort of musical play or a play with songs or a musical depending on where it went. And they called me in, and I had no idea what the meeting was about, and they said, "Have you heard of Roald Dahl's Matilda?" And I sort of took a deep breath and soliloquised, as I do, because I'm a huge Roald Dahl fan and had actually totally coincidentally written to the Roald Dahl estate about the rights of Matilda 10 years earlier because I thought it would make a great musical. So I just sort of said, "Bullshit, are you joking?" "Yeah, damn right, there should be a musical, and it should be like this, and it should be like that." And talked them into commissioning me to do it. So that's the thing that's been dominating my life for the last year and a half, really. And it's done a month of rehearsals. I've barely been in rehearsals because I'm writing my own show and haven't been able to be around, but I was in there this afternoon, and it's, God, it's monstrous. I mean, we're pretty excited about it, but it's such an interesting thing. I mean, being part of something like Storm is one example of how someone like me, who usually is the be-all and end-all of my work, you know, I don't work with writers or directors or anything. Yeah, this is... Matilda's another thing again. I mean, there's hundreds of people involved, and it's crazy.
And is it the same sort of experience? Are you giving them material and letting them go, and are you happy with the result?
Yeah, I mean, the people I'm working with are such... It's being directed and was sort of... the dramatist was Matthew Warchus, who's one of the best theatre directors in the world at the moment. The kind of quality of the people, again, like Storm, once you learn to trust them, you want to let stuff go. You don't want to be the person to make the final call because you know that you're not the most equipped person. So with Matilda, I said, "Do you want to be involved in casting?" "I don't know anything about casting. I'm sure you guys understand the text as much as I do, and with the directions, I'm very happy to let it go." I pop in every now and then and go, "I can't hear every word that singer's saying. Whatever,
fire her."
Yeah, whatever it takes. You know, if you need to drop some dancing or get a new mic, or, you know, I need to hear every single word, you know. And I'm hugely... I write a lot of very lyric-heavy stuff, obviously, I find it very easy to say a lot of things quickly because I've got a little annoying mouth. For the same reason, I don't find it easy to sing with a nice vibrato. I find it very easy to say words fast, but not everyone does. So that's the only thing I come down hard on, because it's very... yeah, it's lots of funny little rhymes, and I've tried to make it very Dali, and not Dali, but Dalesque.
Like Hello Dali?
Yeah. And and I...
melting blocks there.
Yeah, it's mostly a surrealism, basically. It's a little surreal girl who melts halfway through. I'm really excited about Matilda, as excited as I've been about anything.
But then the other thing that you're about to embark on is a tour of, like, various Enormo domes around the country and in Australia with an orchestra.
Yeah.
So, and you've been talking about both of these projects, the Matilda and Storm, about the differences of collaborating with other people rather than working on your own. And here's another example where you're going to do that.
Yeah, well, that's...
You're glutted for punishment in that respect.
This is my year of kind of... getting out of my own microcosm. I, although the orchestra thing's kind of an extension of narcissism rather than a contraction of it, because in that I'm working with 57 people on stage, but they're doing everything I tell them to do. So it's
force them all to wear masks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I was thinking if they can't backcomb their hair, I don't want them on stage.
It's like a Malkovich.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about that. I have got a drummer who looks a lot like me. And I'm going to make him do it. Anyway.
He doesn't know yet.
That's fine. I mean, I'm still... That opens... My first orchestra show is in 7 weeks, and I'm still writing songs, and they still have to get to the orchestrators and be orchestrated for a symphony orchestra. So that's causing me a great deal of stress.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Such a short...
But the great thing is, the way it's going to work is... What I decided when I was offered this opportunity to play with orchestras is that the temptation would be to go, oh, well, I've now got an orchestra. I'm going to lean towards my more quirky, sentimental stuff, which I always have in my shows, which Storm is one of in a lot of ways as well. It's not particularly gaggy. In some ways, it's very sentimental. But, you know, I've got all these ballads and stuff. The temptation is to... slip towards that, but what I decided was to do the opposite and make sure I'm doing more ridiculous and more offensive, not offensive, but more uncompromising stuff. So I'm going to get this orchestra, they're going to be, perhaps without knowing, condoning some pretty strong ideas.
So as an example, will you be getting the orchestra to do your recent Pope song?
Yeah, they'll be doing the Pope song.
Good.
Yeah. And they'll have some jobs to stop playing and say a couple of words at some point in the Pope song as well. For example,
if
they might
heard the Pope song, they'll probably know what that word is.
Well, actually, I think they might say the word Pope, actually. But on the other side, I've got them playing a song called Cheese, and
also highly divisive.
Yeah, exactly. Well, people get pretty passionate about the stinkier cheeses, mm-hmm. and I'm really hoping to make it sublime and ridiculous, and moving and offensive and all that stuff.
We're quickly running out of time, but probably Rebecca, actually, can you say something about Tam Fringe events?
No.
Tracy, can you say something about Tam Fringe events?
There are some Tam Fringe events. You should go to tamlondon.org and learn for yourself. I'm autodidact here.
I am running a Tam Fringe event. As an example, on Thursday night we're doing a pub quiz, and it's going to be a raucous, fun, good time. But that's the great thing. Tam is going to be wonderful, and everybody should pick up tickets. I think there are still a few left, right, Tracy?
Yep.
So you can still pick up tickets, but if it's too much for you, if you can only come into town one day, check out the website, because there's tons of free, mostly free, fringe events, museum tours, pub quizzes, things like that.
As Tim was getting on at the end talking about his terrible sentimental songs, should we... terribly sentimental songs.
Yeah.
Shall we... they're great. Sentimental songs are the best. I was going to say, can we all wish Tim happy 35th birthday today?
Mawkish, yeah.
Yes, birthday.
Thanks. Even more mawkishly, I was only reminded that it was your birthday by my niece Jessica, so... Can Tim say hello to Jessica? Dan?
Hello, Jessica. Thanks for your birthday wishes. How old are you? You sound nice.
That was creepy. That's a good term for the creepy.
I like to keep radio creepy. Keeping radio creepy.
You've been listening to Little Atoms today with me, Neil Denny, and with Rebecca Watson, and we've been joined by Tracy King, DC Turner, and Tim Minchin. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.